Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. Michigan legislators just passed the state's so-called right-to-work law, which forbids employers and unions from agreeing to contracts that require workers to pay fees for union representation. There are currently 671,000 unionized employees in Michigan. Michigan has been called the cradle of the modern labor movement. The United Auto Workers Union was born in a 44-day sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan, back in 1936. The height of the labor movement was in the 1950s, when roughly one in every three American workers was a union member. In 1973, that number began its long decline. In 1980, when Ronald Reagan was president, only 23% of workers were unionized. But today, it's less than 7%, the lowest percentage since the beginning of the 20th century. And there are attacks across the country. So what happened? Today's guest, Jane McAlevey, documents the history of the labor movement and her own experience as an organizer in her new book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. She argues that labor can be revived, but only if the movement acknowledges its mistakes and fully commits to deep organizing, participatory education, militancy, and an approach to workers and their communities that more resembles the campaigns of the 1930s. Jane McAlevey has been an organizer in the labor and environmental justice movements for the last 20 years. And Jane joins me here in studio. Hi, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, as you were driving in today, the Michigan legislature voted 58-51 to pass the state's so-called right-to-work law. And they're also going after the private sector, and the governor is expected to pass these or to sign these bills later today. What's your take on what's happening in Michigan? So many union members said they were blindsided by this.
Yeah, you know, the problem is what's happening in Michigan is just a continuation of what's been happening in this country for, it depends where you start the marker of the attack on American workers and the organizations that can represent them when workers choose to have to form a union. But if we just go back to the 1970s, to the recent attacks, we go to the height of the labor movement. The largest number of workers were still in unions. It held steady until 1973. And in 1973, an organization called the Business Roundtable, this has directly an issue to what's happened today in Michigan and what's happening today in Michigan. 1973, the Business Roundtable forms. It's essentially the modern Chamber of Commerce. And they said, enough. This is just enough. We want to end regulation in America. And end regulation meant two things, end environmental regulation and end labor regulation. The two most powerful types of regulation that go on in this country that actually can cut into the profit margins of overpaid CEOs are environmental and worker sort of regulations. So in 73, on the heels of some of the most robust legislation passing in this country in the 60s and 70s, the Business Roundtable forms and says, enough, we got to roll this all back. We have to stop it. And we want to bring America back to a time when no one had rights to anything, whether it was poisoning their communities, whether it was poisoning the workers in the workplace. And you see this pronounced attack. And I want to raise a name, because this connects to Michigan, that takes us much more current. So Grover Norquist, who we hear about all the time, lately, as the man behind the no taxes pledge in Congress, who's responsible for Tea Party-like formations in Congress. It's Grover Norquist, by the way, who picks up the banner of taking down unions. In 2001, in the American Spectator, Grover Norquist penned an article that everyone should read that calls unions the first of five pillars that need to be demolished and taken down in order for the business class and the elites to retain control in a long-term way of the American electorate. So I think the attacks that we're seeing are deliberate, they're intentional, and even though we won, quote-unquote, the presidential election in 2012, what's happening at the local level is really different than what's happening at the federal level. And, so this is, you know, this is one in a series of a long, prolonged, extenuated attack on American workers. And it's coming, it's not going to stop in Michigan, by the way, right? They passed it in Indiana. They've severely hurt workers' ability to form unions in Alabama and Florida and Wisconsin. Ohio, the workers turned it back with their communities. But, you know, this is an unending mess. And I say to people in California, even every day when I talk to unions, I say, what's the membership going to look like when you wake up tomorrow and there's right to work in the state? And people think it's crazy. It's never going to happen. And that's what they said in Michigan and Wisconsin 5 years ago.
Right. In fact, I heard someone on the radio yesterday actually say, if it can happen in Michigan, it can happen anywhere.
It can happen anywhere. I mean, if you go back to just the Supreme Court imposing President Bush as our president in 2000, you can see many times when the Supreme Court will actually step in and act, when it will pull out a law that it wants to pull out to create national precedent. So even though the California voters and California working people did a terrific job in the last election in California and beat back the latest attempt on unions in California, it doesn't mean that we're not going to be facing a right-to-work situation anytime soon, because there's the Supreme Court. And they've already showed in a series of 5-4 votes that they are interested in making right to work the law of the land. They're ebbing closer and closer to that kind of decision. So that gets to a more fundamental question of sort of what then is the basis? What's the strength? How do unions maintain their strength in America in a high attack mode by outside interests?
Major attack mode. And again, the Senate in Michigan passed these two bills last week, and the Michigan House just passed the first of two right-to-work bills. It was 58-51. It's a Republican-dominated chamber. Governor Rick Snyder says he will sign these bills into law as early as Wednesday. There are about 10,000 protesters outside of the Capitol right now. They brought in cops on horses. So there's a massive movement against these bills, but these houses, like you said, at the state level are mostly controlled by Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, part of what happened in 2010 is, I mean, if you look across the country, there's several things. We're sitting in the Bay Area of California, which is, often referred to as, I don't know, Shangri-La or something in this country, right? So it seems unimaginable to people sitting in the Bay Area what's actually happening in most of America. Although you only have to go as far as Fresno, right, in the Central Valley to sort of look at a power structure that lines up against workers and their families and poor people and people of color and women and the environment and everything.
And you did some work there.
Yes, I did. And the pleasure, actually. I met many fabulous people in Fresno. But the point is that there are sort of red zones in every state. If you look at California's own challenges of trying to pass progressive legislation, ballot initiatives, et cetera, obviously we don't even have it down here in California in terms of how to build a progressive movement to win on every issue. Again, had some good victories this past November, but we don't always have good victories at the ballot in November. So it goes back to this fundamental question. Look at Michigan. You think, well, this is like the home of the UAW. It's the home of auto workers. It's the home of big labor. Michigan is sort of a metaphor for the rest of the country, meaning we had a high unionization rate in the manufacturing sector. And then our economy began to shift enormously. Again, not by accident, by the way. So we begin to transition our highest unionized sectors in this country, the industrial manufacturing base, into very low wage and very anti-democratic countries, whether it's El Salvador, whether it's Mexico in the Maquiladoras, whether it's on to, Burma / Myanmar, China. We begin to take the highest unionized sector of the country and ship the jobs to very low wage and, frankly, anti-democratic nations where workers have zero rights, right? So we begin this intentional attack. And what happens is labor doesn't really keep up. So now we've got American manufacturing workers, the ones left in this country, in direct competition with workers making a dollar a day in a non-democratic country where they have absolutely no rights. So first we've got that scenario where we've got suddenly people say, well, an auto worker in America makes so much more than an auto worker in China. No kidding, by the way, right? They don't have any rights to speak up there. So suddenly it looks like they're overpaid, but they're actually not overpaid, in fact, right? It's that in Michigan, the unions didn't get to keep up with the changing economy. So they were trying to hold on to the manufacturing sector and the unions. But as Walmart and giant service sector companies and retail began to replace manufacturing jobs in America, the American labor movement couldn't keep up. And it's in part because the laws had been so successfully changed from the 70s and the 80s that as the transition in the economy happened, it was virtually impossible to start running the kind of elections that labor used to run in the old days. But you started off talking about Flint and the sit-down strikes. So there's 100,000 workers a day in Flint, Michigan, formed unions in the 1936, 37, 38, in that period. But I want to point out that on the rooftop of the factories were all the wives and all the women who were actually throwing rocks at the guards that were trying to come into the building. So there's a story here about labor's relationship in the 1930s to their broader community and how the broader community took up the case of workers forming unions. And that is a big problem today because there is a gap right now between sort of the union hierarchy and its relationship to the broader community. And when we look at the periods where Unionization happened in great numbers. It's always when organized labor or unions were seen as nothing more than the organization working for all laboring people and not sort of seen as a smaller, quote unquote, special interest, which we can walk ourselves into that trap sometimes as labor.
We're speaking with Jane McAlevey about her new book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. So we've got so much to talk about. Talk a little bit about your argument that in order, and you have so many victories under your belt, and we'll talk about those, but in order for the labor movement to regain its strength, it really does have to go back to the 1930s and embrace the tactics that were used back then. But as you write in your book, so many of the union bosses, the hierarchy, they want really nothing to do with that. I mean, there's a huge split between, they don't even like strikes anymore for the most part. So talk a little bit about what you would like to see, why we should go back to the 1930s.
Yeah, sure. You know, in the book, and I want to say that I wrote this book with Bob Ostertag, who's a longtime progressive journalist from California, a terrific writer, good friend, and terrific journalist. And it was partly at Bob's prompting that I finally sat down and made the time to begin to write up some of the lessons. The book is basically filled with evidence that a different kind of a model for labor organizing works. And that model goes like this. We call it the whole worker theory. And the whole worker theory means that the job of the union doesn't stop when the worker leaves the hospital or leaves the plant gates or punches the clock or whatever it is you do when you leave work. That the idea is that the union doesn't stop and only think about the workplace. Because when a worker leaves work, we go home to all sorts of issues. We've got maybe some kind of toxic contamination near our homes. We've got perhaps not the best public school system in our neighborhood. We've got unsafe tap water. We've got a mortgage crisis. We've got an affordable housing crisis. We've got a racism crisis. We've got any number of huge issues bearing down on our communities. We've got a child care crisis. And the philosophy that we espouse in the book is that it's the labor movement's job to advocate on all of these issues. If we're at less than 7% in the private sector and less than 12% overall, workers in this country in a union, it means that roughly 90% of this country has no relationship to organized labor. So if 90% of this country has no direct relationship to a union, then the argument is that what the unions need to do is broadly take up the issues of the laboring class in this country. And we argue in the book that the way to do that, frankly, is by there are still 16 million people who are in unions. That's a lot. It's an awful lot of people still in unions. If labor leadership said the way that we're going to build a relationship back into the communities so that Americans understand that the only thing between poverty, abject poverty, for all workers and where we are right now is a union, they would simply have a conversation with the rank and file workers. They'd say, where do you go to church? Where's your PTA? Where's your Little League? Where's your mosque? Where's your synagogue? Where's your whatever it is? Let's begin a conversation through the rank and file workers of the America's unions with their own organic communities to sort of create a pathway back to the hearts and minds of America. That's really the argument we're making in the book. And we show through many, many campaigns that the model worked against very stiff opposition.
You write that the problem today is that many of the newly trained organizers are not committed to deep organizing. They're ordered to take shortcuts of all kinds because organizing is too slow, a refrain they often heard from Tom Woodruff, the organizing czar at SEIU, and later changed to WIN. You say that a national union would send a team of talented and trained young organizers to help a group of workers win the vote to form a union and then put them on planes to another election the next day.
Yes.
And that's a huge problem.
That's a huge problem. I mean, so, you know, there's been this sort of shift into what I call shallow mobilizing, which is very different than deep organizing. And that's the contrast that we're laying out in the book. And that goes to the heart of this whole worker theory that I was just discussing with you. So, you know, there is no place in this country right now where poor people, people of color, women, and anyone but the top elite are being educated about how power works in American society. Mm. There's a fundamental question of how does power operate in this country? And so the argument that I'm trying to make in the book is that it's through a union that workers, that ordinary workers in this country can get a basic lesson about how power works, and that it's through the relationship to the rank and file that we can begin to really educate people en masse again about what it takes to make change in this country. Because even just showing up to vote isn't going to do it, right? We just came through an election period. And elections, to me, are nothing but a mobilization. There's how many does each team have, and then how many can you get to the polls? And we confuse sometimes in our labor movement that kind of mobilizing is what leads to deep change and deep organizing. But it's not. Because when you show up and vote once every couple of years and go home, who stays active and busy are the business interests and the people who want to keep American workers down. That's who stays busy during the governing period. So the book calls for a real change. And we say that those best organizers need to get in the field, stay put, and help do leadership development and real rank and file training and education so that our movement can expand to have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of well-trained, well-educated rank-and-file workers growing the labor movement themselves.
We're speaking with Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. And you're saying we, and so I should say you wrote this book with Bob Ostertag. He's a writer. He also teaches at UC Davis and lives in San Francisco. And so today we are talking about what it will really take to rebuild the labor movement. Just about 20 minutes ago, the Michigan House passed the state's so-called right to work law, which forbids employers and unions from agreeing to contracts that require workers to pay fees for union representation. The governor says he will sign this bill. Actually, there are two tomorrow. So what are your thoughts about what workers are currently facing? We're talking a 7% union representation for private sector workers, the lowest percentage since the beginning of the 20th century. Jane argues that in order to rebuild the labor movement, we really have to go back to the 1930s and embrace social movement unionism that involves raising workers' expectations and raising hell. And frankly, Jane, also, well, we'll talk about this, so many of these unions are directly connected to the Democratic Party, connected at the hip. And you write about this. So what are your thoughts about this? What is it going to take to rebuild the labor movement? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And we have a question from Lisa, and she says, it seems to be that the U.S. labor movement needs to work with and create international labor movements if it's ever going to prevent jobs from going overseas. Admittedly, a difficult job, but I'm wondering how much the labor movement has invested in creating a more international movement.
Yeah, great question from Lisa. A, I agree with her. B, one of the positive things that has happened in the last 15 to 20 years in the U.S. labor movement is actually on the question of globalization and international movement building. The nation's largest labor federation, the American Federation of Labor, Congress of Industrial Organizations, that's the AFL-CIO. Again, that's simply our largest labor federation. For the entire period of the Cold War and leading really up until about 1996, had a pretty regressive, retro kind of position on global labor. And in 1995, when at the time President Sweeney was elected and a new slate of people came into the American labor movement in terms of leadership positions, one of the positive results of that has been a sea change in the approach to building global movements of workers. And it's now fully embraced at the AFL-CIO, and it's really fully embraced by most of the organizing unions in this country. But you can see pockets of it happening. There are places where service workers, for example, on security contracts have built some very powerful global movements. Bus drivers have been doing some really incredible work across. But we still don't see the level of embrace that we need to see from big unions in this country. It's a very easy relationship to build is simply by allowing rank-and-file workers between countries to exchange, frankly, do exchanges, which we did a lot of when I used to work at a place called the Highlander Center in the South at a time when a lot of jobs in the late 1980s, so going back 20-plus years, were fleeing the U.S. South and heading into Mexico. There was a lot of sort of rank-and-file workers saying really horrible things about Mexican workers, and we decided There's no way to talk this through. We need to get a bunch of American workers who are saying these horrible things on buses and airplanes and take them into Mexico to meet the quote-unquote Mexican workers stealing their jobs. And this is the kind of education with the rank and file that we need to do all the time. So we begin to do a series of exchanges where we took white working class workers from the U.S. South and took them over the border into Mexico to meet, quote-unquote, the people, quote-unquote, stealing their jobs. Mm-hmm. And it was a profound sea change where the workers realized this is about a giant multinational corporate system screwing all of the workers across the world. So I think there has to be much more of it. I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to connect up workers across borders, and I think it's magic every time it happens. We need more aggressive efforts on that direction. But I also feel like the slight thing I'd like to say back to Lisa and to anyone else on this front is there's plenty of organizing to do at home, too, right now that's not being affected by globalization and global rules. And sometimes I feel like our movement gets caught up with being afraid that globalization has made it so that we can't build robust unions in this country. And that's simply not true. And that, again, is part of the story of the book. I mean, the book is focused on organizing among service workers in this country in a time frame that people said it was impossible to win union elections. We win union election after union election. We win terrific contracts. How? By simply empowering the rank and file workers, by having them stand up, by having them organize their own communities to support them in their efforts. And all that can go on while we do more intentional work across borders.
Can you talk briefly about the relationship between rank and file workers and the hierarchy? Because you write that plenty of labor leaders don't really care for actual workers.
Yeah, well, I'm going to let them speak for themselves. But I can say that in the model of unionism that we were growing, the model of unionism that we were following, is a model that said, for example, all collective bargaining negotiations, I'm trying to give a contrast, are going to be fully open and transparent, and every single worker is welcome into the room. I think that if more labor leaders thought it would be really interesting to allow thousands of workers to participate in their own collective bargaining process, more workers, whether it's in Michigan or in California or anywhere else, would begin to actually understand collective bargaining more than they do. So, I think that unfortunately, look, this is a bit of a tough love book, right? I mean, I think there's nothing more important in this country than strong unions, period. Every single worker in this country would benefit from a union, whether they're middle class, white, working class, poor, people of color, there is no question. But the practice of unionism has become a little bit like a business in this country. And people look at sort of short-term, narrow interests, which I think even in California happens. Like, well, we just defeated that bad measure 3 weeks ago, so we're okay and safe. We don't have to really change anything we're doing for the next 4 years. And that's got to stop or we're going to lose. We are losing. We are losing every day. And for people who don't think that we're still losing, all they have to do is turn on the news about Michigan today. Mm-hmm. And why we think that we have to wait till some even bigger threat hits the shores of California before rank and file workers begin to have a different relationship to their leadership makes really very little sense to me.
And again, the Michigan House just approved the first of two right-to-work bills that would weaken union power. The Republican-dominated chamber passed this measure 58-51. 10,000 protesters are at the Capitol. Cops on horses wearing riot gear showed up. The Governor Rick Snyder, Republican, says he will sign these bills. There's also one dealing with public sector workers. He will sign these bills as early as tomorrow.
So we're
going to take a quick break, so hold that thought. We're talking today with Jane McAlevey. She is a longtime labor and environmental activist. She's out with a new book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. And we'd love to hear from you. What will it take? We do so many shows about this, but as we're seeing these attacks across the country, what will it take to fight back against these attacks and then also truly rebuild the labor movement? I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
Every Tuesday on Your Call, the team sends out a weekly email newsletter. It helps all of us keep up on what's coming up on the show. Gives resources to let us learn more about it and get involved. If you subscribe today, you'll know what's coming up, and you can submit your questions and comments before the show goes on the air tomorrow. It's free and easy to sign up. Just go to yourcallradio.org and click on the link that says Email Newsletter. And you can participate in today's show by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rosa Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will continue our discussion on drones. Last Wednesday, she talked about overseas drones. Tomorrow, she's going to talk about the proliferation of domestic drones. According to the Federal Aviation Association, by 2033, there will be 30,000 drones flying in the U.S. So who's making these drones? Who's buying them? How influential is the drone industry lobby? And what are police departments going to do with these drones? That is tomorrow. And then on Thursday, what is next for the legalization of marijuana, with voters in Washington and Colorado voting for recreational use? And I'm wondering if drones will be used to fly over marijuana fields. It's fascinating. I mean, it's kind of scary, obviously, but to find out what these domestic drones are doing. So tune in tomorrow and on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the history of the labor movement, the state of the labor movement, and what it will take to strengthen it. We're joined by Jane McAlevey. She's author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. She writes about her experiences in California, in Nevada, really moving all across the country to work with the rank and file on these very important issues. She spent 20 years organizing in the labor and environmental justice movements. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about how did we get here? Seeing all of these right-to-work laws pass, attacks on unions, what will it take to strengthen the labor movement? We've got full lines, but we'll have one open in just a couple minutes. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Yeah, I think that it will take a lot, and I agree with your guest 100%. It's going to take the education of the American people, how they were ripped and robbed out of their whole jobs and education, everything else, by the new conservative and new liberal movements, which have been still in effect. Unfortunately, it control both parties, so it is hopeless. It's going to take a lot of education, so people start voting for their self-interest instead against the self-interest, which they have done from Reagan time when he brought all of this filthy people like Friedman and Greenspan and the rest of them who have sold us bill of goods. Is also to really be practical. We have, and I lived through that. I saw jobs disappearing in America from 1980s when I owned big, huge business. And this war also not only against unions, also against really small businesses. Not the small business that the Republicans talk about. They are not talking the kind of small business they have. They're talking about big business, not small businesses. What I like to say, we need radical solution right away, immediately. We can't wait. More people are closed down. More businesses are closed. It is awful situation. We need an immediate moratorium on imports. We have to push it. The American people have to do that. It doesn't benefit us whatsoever to have this junk made in China or anywhere else and to come and throw it in the garbage can after a week or two or three. And it doesn't help the American worker also to compete with somebody who is making 50 cents a day or less. And it doesn't even help us for people in China or Mexico or other places to work slave labor. And we'll have all of us to boycott Walmart, Target, and all kind of stores that promote this philosophy. It is awful. You have no idea how angry I am at this whole system where the American people got ripped off by dozens of people. They called themselves new conservative or new liberal, and the whole economy was based in the stock market, not what is good for you and I and the rest of us.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ede. And Ede owns an electronics store in the East Bay, so he's seen this all happen in terms of outsourcing and wages and just what's going on with the labor movement. So thank you so much, Ede. We'll get a comment in just a minute. I just want to take a few more callers. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. I find myself in disagreement with the guest. She spoke of the magic, that was the word she used, the magic of taking workers from the United States on a bus trip to Mexico to see that the Mexican workers were not really their enemies. And when she left and the magic was over, then she came back, and I'm quite sure the Mexican workers couldn't unionize because they'd get their heads blown off. I'm afraid that my perspective is that she's wrong about going back to the 30s. Back in the 30s, when they went, workers went to General Motors and Ford and said, we want to unionize, and took the actions that she described, Ford and General Motors didn't say, well, if you go on strike, we're moving our production abroad. Now that's exactly what they say. And when work, when jobs do come back to the United States, so-called come back, such as the General Electric new park in the Midwest, the wages are one-third lower than they were before. So I think that she just glosses over this. There's an old saying that you can't know the right answers until you know the right questions, and I don't think you can decide to what kind of new facts you want until you know the actual facts that are existing. And I'm surprised that she seems to not pay much attention to these aspects.
All right, William, we'll get a response, and if you'd like, you can stay on the line to respond. Jane?
Sure. I mean, I think that William's point is well made, but I think I want to just talk about this by example for a moment. The first thing is that the dominant jobs in today's economy are not, unfortunately, anymore in a manufacturing plant. So what the laborman has to do is pay attention to the millions and millions and millions of workers who are toiling in the service economy, right? We've gone from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. 150 years ago, we went from an agrarian economy to a manufacturing economy. We're in that level of a sea change in terms of what's going on in this country. My work in the last 15 years was really focused on service workers in America, mostly women, mostly people of color, and primarily in the healthcare system. So first of all, let's acknowledge that those are not jobs that are as easily moving overseas right now as others, but that's true of many jobs in today's economy. So first things first, the auto workers' jobs became good jobs in the 1930s because they unionized. It wasn't that they were a good job in the 1910s or 20s. And the way that the service workers in this country are going to convert crappy jobs into middle-class sustainable jobs is by having a fight to unionize this country all over again. We didn't wake up with a good manufacturing sector. We built a manufacturing sector that worked for American workers. We have to build a service sector that works for the workers in this country, and that's going to take a lot of direct organizing. So in Nevada, as an example, when I went to Nevada and began to help workers form unions, we understood that there was a beaten-down private sector and there was a public sector government part of the union whose wages and working conditions and benefits were much better. And that was before the new pronounced attack on the government workers, right? But we saw a mini version of this. I'm just going to go right to Will's point. So when I began to work with workers in Nevada, we said to the government workers, look, hey, at the moment you've got a much better wage package and benefits package than the rest of the private sector in the state. And the only way that we're going to be able to either A, defend what you've got and help you keep it is by reorganizing the private sector in America to win. And in just 3 years, which is the story the book tells in gory, incredible detail, in 3 years, we took the private sector in the Las Vegas area and eventually in Reno and Elko and other parts of Nevada and radically transformed the living conditions of the workers. And that was by workers themselves deciding to pick up a fight and make a fight to unionize and to stand strong and to be militant. And in just 3 years, people went from, for example, paying $400 a month for dependent coverage for health care to fully employer-paid free family health care. Mm-hmm. They went from, they essentially had consistent 10% raises every year for 3 years. We took wages from being some of the worst healthcare wages in the country to some of the best healthcare wages in the country. We reinstituted the first private sector pension, and I don't mean a 401k, I mean a pension, right? So you could literally see workers in action with a strategic plan stepping forward and ready to fight. And in just 3 years, they changed an entire private sector market, which then both undergirded the public sector, but also gave new life to a private sector unionization drive. And that's the kind of effort that we need to see in the service sector and the private sector all across America right now to make our economy work for workers. That's what workers did in the 20s and 30s, and we have to do it again.
And to this point, you write about the organizing at the, specifically at the, these hospitals in Nevada. And Deepak writes, can you please share an example of a story of one of the workers you worked with who became a leader and an organizer in the way that you've been describing? And maybe you can use Nevada as an example.
Oh, sure. Oh, my goodness. So Joan Wells is an extraordinary worker. What a great question. Jen Wells is a registered nurse who was involved in an extraordinary unionization drive in Nevada. And by the way, Joan's story is a good one because here's what happened to Joan. She'd been a 20-year nurse. She had had nothing but good write-ups on her evaluation. And this is the part of organizing that people in America don't understand. Too many people don't understand. Joan begins the effort to fight for more rights and a better life and so that she could take care of her patients better in Nevada, and finds herself fairly quickly after that fired by her employer because she was clearly identified as a leader in the union. Rather than backing down, Joan, you know, joined the staff of the union, became a full-time organizer in the union, and went on to help several other hospitals worth of workers actually form unions. We got Joan's job back. She won close to $200,000 in a back pay settlement against her vicious employer who had fired her. But because the workers understood and believed in and had a transparent relationship inside of their union, they understood that Joan was going to continue the fight, both as a rank-and-file worker and as a full-time organizer. And there were literally hundreds of rank-and-file workers in Nevada who would take time off from their job, get in a car, drive to the next hospital, or fly up to Reno, or fly to Elko to say, here's what we just did. Here's what we just won. Here's how we changed our lives, and you can do it too. And that message of workers themselves carrying the message to their coworkers and to other facilities, that's the argument we're making in the book, that the way we're going to rebuild the American labor movement is when workers are excited about their unions, when they win something real, and when they go out and tell that story again and themselves go knock on doors to say to unorganized workers, oh my God, look what we just did. We went from $400 a month in dependent coverage for our health care to free. Why don't you join us?
And just to let listeners know how what you were dealing with in Nevada, you're talking about national for-profit hospital chains. And I didn't realize that Nevada is dominated by these for-profit hospital chains. And luckily, this isn't the norm across the country.
Yeah, it's not the norm for now. But right. I think they would like to have it become the norm, right? I mean, there are many things that we still don't quite understand about the changes in the healthcare law. But the future of healthcare workers, I think, is not one that we've spent enough time thinking about. But so in Nevada, we had, again, unusual market in that it was dominated by big for-profits. And they pulled no punches in trying to stop workers from forming unions. They would not think twice about spending $10, $15, $20 million per campaign to try and stop workers who simply wanted the right to collectively bargain over how many workers were on shift, how many patients, you know, could one nurse or one tech or one aide possibly handle and still do a good day's job. So they were up against incredibly stiff opposition. And there's no way that unless there's a full embrace by the workers of the process that they're going through themselves, there's simply no way that you can out-muscle that kind of an opposition unless you've got tens of thousands of workers involved in the process themselves and owning it and believing it and understanding that they themselves are the very best agent to promote the growth of unions.
And these are very politically well-connected hospitals also.
Yeah,
right.
Well, sure. HCA, one of the hospital corporations that we went up against, and there's a few of them here in California, too, but not too many. At the time, for example, is owned by the Frist family. And Bill Frist, you might remember back at that moment, was, in fact, the head of the U.S. Senate, United States Senate. Right. So if you look at political power, again, my argument earlier in the show that we're not teaching people how power really works in America. I mean, all we had to do was walk into the hospitals and explain the ownership patterns, who owned some of the biggest hospital systems in America, the for-profit ones, and how well the system was rigged for them, right? They took over the U.S. Senate to advance their business interests, and we're so far from being able to do that right now as a progressive movement. It's sort of frightening. Mm.
And Jane writes about this and what went on behind the scenes and the victories in her new book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. Jane McAlevey is a longtime labor rights and environmental rights organizer. And we've got just over 10 minutes left. If you'd like to join us, we have a couple of free lines. If you'd like to talk about what your thoughts are about how we got here, Michigan passing the latest right to work law. It's expected to be signed by the governor tomorrow. What are your thoughts about where we are today, and how will we really strengthen the labor movement? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about Jane's argument that we need to go back to the 1930s and really give the power to the rank and file? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thanks again for calling, William. Let's go next to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, hi. Jane is obviously very well-spoken and a good representative of the union movement. And having worked through four unions myself in the city of San Francisco, yeah, I'm sympathetic and support her, but what I've seen is, and what I'm seeing in Michigan, and by the way, the right-to-work rule, just really quickly, is pretty confusing. Mm-hmm. Right-to-work sounds like a good thing, and so just in terms of throwing that term around, it's amazingly confusing. So my point is that union reps, I've experienced, are amazingly ignorant, not well-spoken like Jane, don't really know how to drill home a simple bit of oratory. If you want to see good oratory on the fly, just look up the YouTube of Mario Savio and the Berkeley Steps, and that is the power of excellent oratory. And so I'm seeing very uneven quality in union messaging. I'm seeing revenge voting against unions. Is there seems to be, rather than I'd like to join a union, it's like, hey, those union guys get paid too much. Let's get rid of unions because the economy sucks. And so just finally, what amazes me most, and we're talking about the power of messaging, let's just go back in the last month about the Hostess bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And everywhere on the news, it was about labor's refusal to capitulate brought Hostess down. Now, none of these fools have jobs. And yet, what gets totally underreported, amazingly, is how, you know, we learned recently in the last 12 hours that the pension funds were raided by Hostess, legal or loophole-wise. That the executives increased, the CEO increased the salary from $750,000 to like $2.5 million. And yet this was promoted in the news. How can you, what's the future of the labor movement if you couldn't even get the news people to report this the way it should have been when the story broke? I'm
right.
Just shocked that the Hostess thing went down the drain. So Jane sounds great, but how did the union movement, labor movement, blow that on just getting the truth out on Hostess?
Well, you know, Ken, you bring up so many good points there. So first off, why don't we talk about the messaging? And he's got a really good point about this right-to-work law. Hey, it sounds great. I've got the right to work. Can you just give us a brief explanation? What do these right-to-work laws actually do?
Yes, well, we often jokingly call them, but in seriousness, the right-to-work-for-less laws. So, you know, the right-to-work laws essentially make it so that even when a majority of workers vote to form a union in their place of work, they don't all have to join and pay membership dues. That's sort of at the most simplistic level, right, what these right-to-work laws are. They can come packaged with any number of other little goodies for American workers in the states that they're in, but fundamentally they're about weakening unions. That's all the bottom line is. Now, I have to say that it's a little tricky to talk about today because we're in the middle of the Michigan, the attack in Michigan, and I want to separate the pronounced attack on American workers and their organizations, that's unions. But honestly, in Nevada, we were operating in a right-to-work state. So it's also true that when you build the kind of union that I'm describing, a hyper-democratic union where workers are very much involved, where workers are asked to be involved, where workers are asked to step up their activity every single day, you can survive in these kind of states, but it takes an extraordinary level of organizing and mobilization on a daily basis. So, you know, I make the analogy to, look, we live in California. We all pay taxes in California. We can't really opt out of that system. I happen to believe in taxes. So, you know, union dues are a self-taxation system that workers themselves make the decision to pay. So these laws are about one thing only, which is trying to break the financial resources of American labor unions. But I want to go back to another point about the messaging.
Yes.
From the call. And I think going back to the whole worker theory that we're laying out in the book, I agree with the point that the caller is making. But part of why we're arguing that if the unions would begin to expand out the concept of looking at broader issues that are affecting the lives of the workers when they leave work, and if unions would begin to, like, imagine this scenario in California, if every union woke up today in California and said, we're going to go have a conversation with every single rank and file worker in the state, and we're going to ask every single rank and file worker two questions. What matters to you when you leave work every day? Whether it's childcare, whether it's unemployment, whatever it is, right? There's a ton of issues in every community. Affordable housing, mortgage crisis, I'm getting thrown out, whatever it is, right? So ask two questions. One, what matters to you when you leave work every day? And then secondly, tell us about all the relationships that you hold already in your community. What little league do you participate in? What soccer club do you attend where there's parents sitting on the lines watching all the kids hang out and play if they have the luxury of doing that? What churches or synagogue, again, religious institutions do you attend? And then began a coordinated conversation to have rank-and-file workers sit down and begin to do the education of their community about what their union means to them. And then those people, in a rippling effect, began to have conversations in a broader way inside of their churches, their neighborhoods, their communities, their little leagues, their coffee clubs, their PTAs about what the union means to them. The messaging would completely shift because a majority of people in American communities would then understand the value of unions. That's the kind of messaging shift that we think is going to happen through a sort of a grassroots, face-to-face dynamic whereby workers are brought into direct engagement with their broader communities about the role that unions play in their lives.
And so the problem we have here is I think there are maybe two or three reporters in this country dedicated to the labor movement, which means that you rarely hear these voices in the media, yet they are out there, right? 10,000 right now protesting in Lansing, Michigan. So can you talk about that? And then also, I mean, you have all these great stories, I have to say, about people like the AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Richard Trumka, who freaked out because he didn't have black pepper on his sandwich. And you talk about how everybody wanted to get him the right lunch. I mean, you've got all these great little inside stories about what goes on behind the scenes. But what can you reveal to us about the thinking of the people with the power who do focus now on the pollsters and the messaging when they have all of these people who want to use their voices, but they say, let's just deal with the pollsters. And then their connections to the Democratic Party and how that's affecting organizing. I know that's a big question, but you just have these good insights that I think we could really benefit from.
You know, I think there are two things. One is that there's a relationship between the leadership of the American labor movement and the Democratic Party that needs to be separated. It's fine, perhaps, to team up during the election cycle for elections to elect people who are probably going to give workers a better shot than not. But that, by the way, doesn't always mean the Democratic Party at this point. We have plenty of bad Democrats, right? And in the book, we talk about the strategy that we were running, which was something like a precursor to the Tea Party. We were running a strategy about electing actually pro-worker, by the way, pro-regulation, pro-tax, pro-worker, Democrats, and running bad Democrats out of the party. And that is not to say that we shouldn't one day have our own party, but we're a little bit far from that right now. So the book outlines a couple of strategies. One is that we were running and challenging Democrats from within the party heavily and running rank and file workers themselves. So it would do two things. It would, one, create a bench of people who could run for higher and higher office who actually came out of the rank and file of the labor movement. And the second thing is that, you know, we, by the way, in the book we call it a target-rich environment, right? Bad Democrats, they're everywhere. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. So if the labor movement would be a little more risk-taking and decide to run tons of its own rank and file who are every bit capable of running for office in this country. I mean, I've met so many workers who should be running their hospitals and running the country. We should just be running them for office against bad Democrats. That's like sort of step one. Step two is the relationship is so polluting between the party, the Democratic Party, and labor leaders. you know, in the last couple of weeks during the quote-unquote fiscal cliff, this manufacturer debate we're having about a fiscal cliff, which most American workers went off decades ago, by the way. But so here we have a situation where the way that labor leaders measure power is, did we get invited to the White House to sit in the room and have a conversation about the fiscal cliff? When my argument is, an indication of our power is, could those labor leaders put 400,000 workers around the White House and surround it when John Boehner walked into the White House, right? That would be an indication of power, not whether or not a bunch of people in suits got to go sit down in the White House. That didn't do anything for American workers from 2008 to 2012. And we're starting to see it again. And so the question is, you know, how do you, can rank and file union members demand a change in approach to elections in this
and
country?
And one day it's the CEO of Walmart in the White House, and the next day it's the head of the SEIU.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Well, we've got time for just a few more callers. Let's hear from Anonymous in Central Valley. Hi, welcome to the show. Let's try Alec in Oakland. Hi, Alec.
Hi, Rose. I'm in the carpenters union.
And we only have 30 seconds.
Okay. I just want to know what you people think about the responsibilities of union members. Most of the guys I work with shop at Walmart. So, you know, union members don't care. Everybody wants what's cheap. That's all I
got to
say.
Well, thank you. And I'm glad you brought up Walmart, because Walmart workers don't even use the word union. They're simply saying, we want an end to retaliation, we want a living wage, and some full-time work would be nice.
Yeah, God bless them. And I hope that the brother from the Carpenters Union can help take the responsibility to educate his coworkers about why the perversity that the Walton family owns. You know, the Walton family who owns Walmart has enough wealth that outstrips 40% of the combined income of America.
Right.
That's so insane. And the only way that that's going to change is when brothers like the guy from the Carpenters Union who just called, that's my family's union, stand up and begin to educate their coworkers that we've got to support a unionized work. We've got to shop and use consumer practices that support unionized workplaces in this country.
So 20 seconds, final thoughts.
You know, final thoughts. Look, the story in the book is that I have tremendous faith and hope in American workers and in ordinary people and in poor people in this country. And every single place that I had the pleasure of helping workers form unions and fight for contracts, we in fact won, and they in fact changed history. And again, I want to remind people that we didn't get to a great middle class supporting economy just because manufacturing bosses were nice. It's because people forced a fight in this country. We have to do it again in the service sector right now.
Jane McAlevey is author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. Jane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Is there a right way to use domestic drones in the U.S.? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the proliferation of domestic drones. According to the Federal Aviation Association, by 2033, there will be about 30,000 drones flying in the U.S. So who's making them, who's buying them, and how influential is the drone industry lobby? What are the legal and privacy issues associated with domestic drones? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.